From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Today's culture wars echo the deep divisions of the 1960s. Back then, the generation that weathered the Depression and World War II was suddenly confronted by women's lib, black power, and young people who wanted to make love, not war. Meanwhile, the bombing went on, and the body counts kept rising.
15,000 Americans and a few hundred thousand Vietnamese died in that war in 1968 alone. It was the bloodiest year of the war.
Today, Mark Kurlansky remembers 1968. What does it mean for the world now? Also, how the children of the 60s paid for their parents' politics. And Ana Menendez pays homage to Che Guevara.
The only way that I myself can get at my own personal history is to accept contradictions, that something can be both good and bad, and to live with that.
The evening news became a habit in the 60s, and it was scary. Television brought the world into our living rooms. We could see for ourselves just how different other people were. We were suddenly right there when shocking things happened. And there was a lot happening.
The date, April 23rd, 1968.
Am I to understand then that I'm not allowed to leave this building?
Well, let me ask. Is he to understand that he's not to be to leave this building?
Yeah!
Senator Kennedy has been shot. Is that possible?
No!
Is that possible?
No!
It's good.
Everybody
out! You're listening to the legal free radio station Hradec-Králové, Czechoslovakia. Let the whole world know the truth.
News reports from the 60s. Mark Kurlansky thinks 1968 is the year that rocked the world. In fact, that's the subtitle of his book, called simply 1968. Kurlansky told Steve Paulson that TV played an important role in that tumultuous year.
It just happened that 1968 was a critical moment in the development of television. They were just beginning to get the technology together on satellite transmissions, and also the switch from film to videotape, which didn't have to be processed so that you could broadcast immediately after something happened, which is, you know, what was done in the riots at the Chicago Convention. The riots were still going on as people were watching it on television.
This is real bedlam. This is the worst it's been so far here in Chicago. Police running across here.
Another factor in making 1968 what it was is the whole more than 10 years of the civil rights movement that had gone before it. And the civil rights movement had become fairly sophisticated at how to get television coverage and had been watched all over the world and was greatly admired all over the world.
Now, certainly one of the momentous events in 1968 was the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. How did that change the political landscape?
There was a lot of change going on in the civil rights movement at the time, and it was not swinging Martin Luther King's way at all. A lot of people were losing faith in the whole concept of nonviolence, and it was being replaced by black power. And there was a split, a tension. And of course, the nonviolent approach completely lost out when its most important spokesperson was killed.
I'm only going to talk to you just for a minute or so this evening because I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings.
If you just think of who Martin Luther King was, not the saint that he has been made into since his death, but the real man who is this eloquent rebel. We could have had his voice for the past 35 years. What a loss that has been to this country. I mean, it's just staggering when you think about it.
There must be some kind of way out of here. Say the Joker to the thief.
Now, from an international perspective, certainly if you were an American at the time, the Vietnam War was the issue, and the protests against the war had been escalating over the years, but they seemed
not
to...
Not only if you were an American, huge anti-war movements all over the world. It was the age of decolonization, and Vietnam was seen as a former colony that was struggling for its independence at a time when Europe had been forced to move away from its imperialism, and the United States seemed to be filling that gap and playing the role of the imperialist oppressor.
So why did things come to a head over Vietnam in 1968?
Well, because it was the worst year of the war. 15,000 Americans and a few hundred thousand Vietnamese died in that war in 1968 alone. You know, every week in 1968, the U.S. killed more people in Vietnam than died in the World Trade Center attack. It was the bloodiest year of the war. And it was also the year when it just became completely obvious that the government and the military were lying about the progress of the war, that there was, in fact, no building of democracy, that the South Vietnamese government was completely corrupt and unpopular, that the U.S. military, in spite of winning battle by battle, was not winning the war.
Yeah, come on, all you big strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again. He's got himself in a terrible jam. Way down yonder in Vietnam. So put down your book, pick up a gun. We're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's one, a two, a three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's five.
One of the results of all of this ferment about the Vietnam War and the sobering reality that the U.S. was not going to win this war was that President Lyndon Johnson decided not to run for re-election.
Yeah, one of the big mysteries really of the year for a fighter like Johnson, there was still every reason to believe that he could win the nomination in the election, and it was very uncharacteristic of him to bow out in a real bombshell because, you know, everybody's thinking about the year was based on the power of Lyndon Johnson.
I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes or to any duties other than the awesome duties of this office, the presidency of your country. Accordingly, I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Now, one of the responses to his dropping out is that Bobby Kennedy emerged as a leading candidate, probably the leading candidate for the Democratic Party, and he seemed to be a viable peace candidate who could actually become president.
Yeah, and he was who they had wanted in the first place. I mean, there were a group of anti-war people such as Allard Lowenstein who sought to put up an anti-war candidate, and the anti-war candidate they had wanted was Bobby Kennedy, but he refused to run, and so they settled on Gene McCarthy, and they were very unhappy with McCarthy. He just didn't run a good campaign. Very popular among college kids, but in those days, college kids couldn't vote. The voting age was 21. Of course, a lot of McCarthy people were very angered later when Bobby decided to step in. But, I mean, here was a guy who, as you say, was a very viable candidate, had the not only the Kennedy name, but boundless energy and political skills.
But then that dream of another Kennedy in the White House abruptly ended. He was assassinated in California.
Yeah, I mean, what a profound change in the history of this country that was. You know, it seemed almost like 1968 was a year of tremendous hope and optimism in some ways, and so much of that died in California when he was shot.
But what we had then was the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Again, all hell broke loose there.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to note that when Daley had managed to get the convention in Chicago, there was a convention center that subsequently burned down. And so all these venues were shifted, and the way it was now set up to march from the park to the convention meant marching through his neighborhood, you know, and he wasn't going to let a bunch of hippies march through his neighborhood.
And it's true that part of the response was that, look at all these long-haired kids protesting against the Vietnam War. I mean, one way to read
this is in
middle America, those protesters did not come off looking
too
good.
It was initially very much against Daley, and even the government report was against Daley and said that, you know, it was a police riot. But as time went on, it swung more to his favor and against the demonstrators.
The confrontation was not created by the police. The confrontation was created by the people who charged the police. Gentlemen, get the thing straight once and for all. The policeman isn't there to create disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder.
Now, another hotbed of ferment in 1968 was Paris. The students were talking openly of revolution, and it wasn't just the students. There were a lot of other people who were joining in as well, and they were united by this hatred of their leader, General de Gaulle.
Yeah, I mean, de Gaulle was a 19th-century man and a 19th-century leader, and many people in France felt that he was holding them back. But there was this tremendous illusion that they had taken over the country because the workers went on a general strike at the same time the students were striking and effectively completely shut down the country, and you couldn't buy gasoline, you couldn't buy anything. And this made a huge impression on students in America and students in Mexico and everywhere because, you know, that's how you make a revolution, is you get the students and the intellectuals hand in hand with the workers, and then you've done something. You've done a revolution.
But there were massive protests, particularly in Paris, weren't there?
Yes. Well, there was a moment when they closed the country down, just completely closed the town.
You know, when you look back at 1968, it seems that the world was a much worse place by the end of the year than the beginning. I mean, you saw the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, saw the Prague Spring crushed, the Vietnam War was spiraling out of control, any sense of compromise was going out the window. I mean, the militants were taking over in various movements. Is that your take?
You know, you have to ask, given all the really terrible things that happened in 1968, why do people look back on it with nostalgia? And I think that one of the main reasons why they do is that there was this tremendous optimism about political activism. There was the belief that you could change the world. If you had no other avenue open for expression, you could stand out in the street and scream, and thousands of people would scream with you, and you had a voice.
Mark Kurlansky is the author of 1968, The Year That Rocked the World. He spoke with Steve Paulson. And what do today's young people think about the 60s? We asked some students on the University of Wisconsin campus.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
When I think about the 60s, I think about strife and social upheaval and change.
All the protests against the war and different cultures emerging, like hippie culture and things like that.
60s is a while ago, but seemed like it'd be a sweet time to live.
First thing that comes to mind is hippies and a lot of marijuana.
Tie-dye shirts, hemp.
Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Of the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King, JFK, big time of change.
The 60s are hippies.
You think of the hippie movement in like Vietnam, I guess.
Bands and parades and marches against wars and whatnot.
Good rock and roll music. Political activism, I guess.
Also international
events, like in the late 60s, especially the Prague Spring in 1968?
I think about hippies and tie-dye and political controversy.
Dancing, music, drugs, pretty much carefree times.
Coming up, the personal cost of the new freedoms. And who had to pay for it?
He did have one sober year, the only year of my life when he was sober, and I still remember it as one of the best years of my life. I was 10.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Becoming an adult is never easy. Take a flower child and a surfer, throw in the dramatic social upheavals of the 60s, then add a new baby, and you've got serious stress. Turned out to be more than her parents could handle. Joelle Frazier reconstructs their lives in a memoir called The Territory of Men. And she doesn't blame her parents for their choices, even the ones that caused her pain.
They were such loving people. They always were searching for love in their lives, and they're also sort of hedonists, I guess, you know, always searching for the wonderful in life, the pleasure in life. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that's what brought them together. And sometimes I think that's the one thing, the one person that each of them has always missed.
Hmm. How did they meet?
They met at the University of Oregon, left to New York, and when she got pregnant with me, they went back to California.
Do you know much about their lives before you?
Yeah, I do. Over time, I've learned a lot. I felt like I needed to do that for the book, too, to understand where they came from, to better understand them. So, yeah, I researched their past a little bit.
So what were their lives like in New York?
Oh, it was wild. They were all-night parties and kind of bohemian, beatnik sort of style of life. You know, really loved Kerouac kind of thing. And, you know, a lot of gin and tonics and reading books and poetry and that sort of thing.
And they really wanted to be writers.
Yes, and they both worked at magazines.
And they actually both were writers. You have a journal of your mother's that you quote.
Yeah, I was so grateful that she had the courage and the generosity to give me that journal to work with, because these were her words from her early 20s when I was just an infant. And so verbatim, I was able to quote her. And at the same time, it was very heartbreaking to have that journal, because it chronicled the sort of evolution of the breakup and then finally her leaving him and then the divorce. So someone quoted it as saying it's like my own personal train wreck, yeah. Watching my parents divorce day by day, seeing my mother get closer to that decision.
Well, also there is early on her surprise at becoming pregnant. Someone less strong than you are might have taken that as an attack.
Yeah, well, it was hard for me to realized that I wasn't planned and that it wasn't necessarily a good thing. In fact, it was, I think for both of them, was seen as a hindrance to their freedom and their dreams. And so it's really hard to hear that.
But on the other hand, you don't write as though you felt rejected by them. There wasn't any question of their wanting you once you were there.
Not at all. No. Once I was there, I think that I was just part of their lives. And I think there were no regrets.
You all did stay together for a while.
Almost 2 years.
And, of course, you can't be expected to remember very much of that yourself.
No.
Do you have any memories of that are yours?
No, I don't. I have, when you see photos of those early years when you're a toddler, it kind of seems to create its own memory. But in actuality, no, I don't remember anything from those baby years.
And after the split, you lived mostly with your mother. What was that like?
I became very aware of my mother and her moods and how they would change around men. And she would seem to become more alive and more happy when they're around, unless, of course, there was fighting. And then when they were gone, a sense of agitation and a sense of waiting and something being incomplete. A lot of women are like that. I mean, my mother, incredibly dynamic and gorgeous. She was a model, a swimsuit model even, at least in college, but yet still feeling incomplete without a man, you know, wanting that to feel whole.
Did you ever get to live with your father?
Definitely, mostly with my mom. But I did visit him on vacation, summers and Christmases. I'd go to Hawaii. And I was very close to him. I wrote him letters all the time, and he wrote me. And he was like this prince to me, you know, living in magical Hawaii.
What was he doing all those years?
Just odd jobs. He'd work as a golf pro or an insurance guy or just come up with some entrepreneurial thing. But he really always wanted to write, and he was constantly trying to write. And he finally did publish a novel.
And you've read it, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
How hard was it for him to write that novel?
I think it was torture for him, as, you know, writing is so hard anyway. But it took him several years, and in the midst of it, he was drinking. So I call it this strange triangle between him and his notepad and his bottle or glass of whatever alcohol it was. That triangle of writing and drinking and my father was very bittersweet.
There's always a notion among fantasists that somehow men like your father could only write with the bottle. But actually, it sounds as though you thought maybe he wrote better when he was fighting the bottle.
I think so. And he did have one sober year, and he wrote a lot during that year. In fact, I think he was on a roll, but he couldn't last. And he started drinking after about a year. But I did know him that sober year, the only year of my life that I knew him when he was sober, and I still remember it as one of the best years of my life. I was 10.
How did you feel about those times when your mother would pack you off to live with your dad again? I suppose it must be very mixed. On the one hand, you get to go live with your dad. On the other hand, you don't get to live with your mother.
Yeah. Oh, how painful. It really was. And there was also the sense that when my mother packed me off, it was because I wasn't getting along with the stepfather in question at the time. And so I knew that my departure was to give her more peace, and I was in the way, so to speak. So that was kind of painful. And missing her was hard, and feeling like I had failed her somehow was difficult, obviously. But I loved being with my dad, and yet it was difficult to watch him drinking. So everything always seemed to have this dark and light side to it, as I guess all of life does.
Yeah. But this story, even though it's all defined by men, is also a two-woman story, you and your mother and the interaction between you. It has to have been up and down during that time, because you seem, especially when you were young, to be defining yourself by your relationship with her.
Yeah, it's definitely been up and down. And I think you're right that in the end, the book is about me and my mom, because she's the one who introduced me to the territory of men. She's the one who taught me about it. Like, I'm not talking literally, but by her actions, by example, she led me into the territory of men. And that's where I would find my happiness. And I say that in quotes. And so I followed in her footsteps. And for probably the last, 15 years, I did what she did, kind of went from man to man, searching for that sort of elusive sense of contentment and safety, which you can't find, in somebody else. It obviously has to come from within, and it's kind of a cliche, but I've lived that cliche.
Joelle Frazier's memoir is called The Territory of Men. We're remembering the 60s this hour. If you'd like to comment on anything you've heard or add something to the discussion, send us email through our website. The address is www.ttbook.org. Ana Menendez is the daughter of Cuban exiles who fled to Los Angeles during the 60s. She was raised to detest Fidel Castro and all he stood for. After working as a journalist for several years, Menendez became a full-time writer of fiction. She isn't bound by her parents' Cuba. Her novel, called Loving Che, paints a vivid portrait of revolutionary Cuba and its other guiding spirit, not Fidel Castro, but Che Guevara. Ana Menendez read a scene from the book when she talked with Steve Paulson.
If I heard the door open behind me, I made no note of it. There were a group of boys who lived on that floor who were always scurrying about, and I had taken to leaving the door unlocked rather than have to listen to their knocking. Perhaps, I thought, they had wandered in, as they sometimes did, to watch me paint. I heard footsteps, and then that smell, like wet leaves, old earth, metal. I turned quickly to him, and maybe I gasped. He told me later I had gasped, though I have no memory of this. I remember only seeing him there and the strange feeling that it occasioned in me because, except for the very brief moment at my house, I had not really taken a good look at him in person. As he stood before me, he seemed very much the man in the photographs, and at the same time, not at all him. Of course, there are the things that a photograph can't capture. The smell, yes, but also a roundness, a totality. A man whose full face seems gentle and kind may reveal himself something altogether different in profile. Gestures, movements, all these things go into an image of a person or even of an object. He was so alive, a man of breath and skin, and as I stood there with my paints, I saw that within this life of his was also contained death. I would come to read his death in strange places, in the stories he chose to tell, in his walk, in the breath that caught in his chest as if a terrible parting were already wrenching at his heart. But even before all that, even before I knew him, that day in my studio, I could see the death that gently draped him.
You capture so much in that scene, that the connection between revolution and death and that kind of heady mix of eroticism and revolutionary fervor as well. Is this just your image of what Che might have been like, or is this based on what people said of him?
Both. I did an awful lot of research on him for this book, and for instance, I do know that he was not fond of showering.
Was he a ladies' man?
He was not, certainly not by Cuban standards. He was at the beginning of the revolution. In fact, he was very annoyed by his soldiers who were sneaking out at night to meet with girls around the bushes and actually forced everybody into a mass wedding ceremony because he was so annoyed about it. John Lee Anderson, in his exhaustive biography, wonderfully done biography of him, says that he was faithful to his wife in the beginning days of the revolution, all through his time in Cuba, I believe he says. Jorge Castañeda, in his book, says that that's not exactly true, and that a woman named Rosa Lilia Perez gave birth to a son of his. Che himself made some comments about nothing says that a man and a woman have to be together all their lives. Some passages that suggest that he was aware of some of the complexities of the married life.
Isn't that part of his appeal, actually?
I think so.
I mean, there was a certain innocence. And as you say, it's complicated because probably the real story is that he had a brutal side.
Yes, but he was a doctor who could kill.
Yeah, but yet on the other hand, he seems somewhat naive about going off and trying to start the revolution all around Latin America.
Yes, but you're right. There is something beautiful about it. And that's why I chose to tell the story as a love story, a straight love story without politics, because I think the love story itself is the politics.
But that's a fascinating idea, to think that the revolution is really a love story, that the same impulse for why people would rise up and throw out the old dictator is why you'd find a lover?
Well, obviously, it's a metaphorical condensation of that time. There were very many complex feelings going on in Cuba at the time. Many people who had suffered under the previous dictatorship, obviously. It's not to make light of those times, very serious political times. But no, what I mean is the way that people, ordinary people, became buoyed along by the feeling of the era and the intense feelings that it provoked in people to basically change their entire lives and follow this. They came from the same place as these feelings of intense love when one feels this is it. This is going to be the perfect one. This is going to change everything. We'll be happy from now on. And in fact, Celia, who was Fidel's companion for a while, had a wonderful quote, which I stole for this book and put it in Teresa's mouth, that she said those looking back on the early days of the revolution after things had become complicated, she said those were beautiful times, happy times, so we'll never be so happy again. And I think there is a lot that is similar in this sort of feeling of transformation and coming outside of ourselves.
Now, one thing that you do in the story that I think is rather ingenious is Che makes his appearances in the book, but he always remains this elusive, rather mysterious figure. And maybe that's all we'll ever know of him. I mean, that's kind of how he's come down to us in history.
Yes, he very much appears as photographs. Even the sections that are written are very much no deeper than a photograph sometimes. It's a very idealized and almost shallow portrait of him. Again, the type that we might find in books or by reading a photograph, the type of stories we might make from looking at his photograph. And yes, I think this is the way that people come down to us through history. And we can attempt to flesh them out in historical fiction, which this is not. I don't consider this a historical novel. Or we could attempt to flesh them out in biographies, and we do, and that's good. But they'll never really be the full person. They can't be.
You did a lot of research about Che Guevara. You read biographies of him. Do you consider him a heroic figure?
That's a tough question. I guess I would consider him a hero in the Greek sense and all the complexities that that implies. Perhaps a tragic hero of sorts. He certainly served for wonderful inspirations. I think that he's a hero to the extent that he reminds us of keeping the poor in mind and watching out for those who are not in power. I think that his methods leave much to be desired.
So it's more the vision, it's more the ideals of what he stood for, making the revolution on behalf of the people. That's what remains an inspiration. It's not how he did it.
No, it's not. It can't be. Again, when you're talking about rolling firing squads, it's very hard to justify. I mean, people have.
And what did he do with the fire squads?
Well, he was in charge of the firing squads after the revolution that executed former members of the Batista regime and also people who were just caught up in the anti-revolution movement. And there were many abuses that went on. And it's been justified as, well, this is the way things are always done in Cuba. They always kill each other when people come to power. Well, I mean, we're willing to accept a lot of things in other countries that we're not willing to accept in our own. And so I'm not willing to say, well, this is the way it's always been done and it was okay, I'm going to excuse that. I mean, it was a terrifying time for a lot of people. It's easy to picture that time in black and white and say, well, these were the good guys and these were the bad guys. The reality, as it always is in revolutions, is much more complex. Many families suffered tremendously. And it was a period of great hopes, great disillusion, and also great terror. And all those things are true. And so for that reason, I hesitate to either paint him as a hero in the Christ sense or as a devil, which is how he was painted in my family growing up. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes it's okay to just let people remain human and not burden them with our hatreds or our loves. I mean, both of them are equally dehumanizing to some extent.
Now, your parents were living in Cuba during the revolution. They left not long after. I'm assuming they saw the revolution as a disaster.
Well, my parents were actually very young when the revolution started. My mother turned 15 just 18 days after the triumph of January 1st, 1959. So she was very young. My father, I think, was 19, also fairly young. And so I'm not sure. They have an idea of the revolution taking away their childhood and taking away an easy childhood, as mostly all childhoods are. I mean, both my parents were in the middle class and had it relatively easy. They didn't suffer in the countryside. They weren't involved in politics. They weren't tortured by anybody. They weren't shot at. They had a very easy and pleasant childhood. And so for them, the revolution was an upheaval. And it tremendously impacted my mother's family, who were immigrants to Cuba, who had arrived there poor, made a lot of money, and then had it all taken away. So their feelings about it are very personal. Certainly they see it in the greater context of politics, but it's primarily an emotional history for them, and with all the baggage and all the hurt and all the hatred that that implies.
But I can imagine for someone like you, who was obviously born after the revolution, that must be a fascinating time to think about, to wonder what it was like.
Absolutely. Especially when we live such a, well, up until a few years ago anyways, we live such an ordinary life here in the States. And I also wondered what really did happen. Because, for instance, growing up, the revolution was always painted as a complete disaster and as a takeover of the envious, as my mother always described it. I read about it. I read the history of Cuba. I saw it as a little bit more complex. I'm not willing to go out on a limb either way on it, but I do see it as a little bit more complex. I saw that it didn't just come out of nowhere as it had been suggested to me. And so I've always been very fascinated by the stories that we tell about history and how they say more about our own wishes than about history itself. Certainly there are professional historians who are not supposed to be burdened by these emotional memories and so forth. But for the most part, normal human beings, the stories we tell each other about the past are really stories about ourselves and are about our failings and about our triumphs. And all of this interested me about the greater context of the greater historical context of Cuba, because really the history of Cuba in the United States, especially in Miami, is just a series of anecdotes, of family anecdotes. And that was very interesting to me in the sense of, will we ever get to the truth of what happened? Will my generation ever get to the truth of what happened? I don't know.
Ana Menendez is the author of a novel called Loving Che. Steve Paulson spoke with her. Che Guevara is still idolized by many Latin Americans. Here's one of the many songs sung in his honor. It's from a recording made in Cuba in 1968.
Bien, ahora otra guajira, lo eterno. Vengo a traerte un recado de tu pueblo que es mi pueblo. Dice el pueblo Che Guevara que es mentira que hayas muerto.
Tu presencia firme y clara como estrella refulgente sigue alerta el combatiente comandante Che Guevara.
Como tú no mueres ni en la historia ni en el tiempo, ¿cómo habrían de morirse los hombres que son eternos? Comandante, que sigue la voz de acero de tu fusil encendido por el continente entero.
Tu presencia firme y clara como estrella refulgente sigue alerta y combatiente comandante Che Guevara.
Coming up, the lasting legacy of the 60s. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Che Guevara t-shirts were pretty common on American college campuses in the late 60s. Not anymore. So what do today's college students think of the 60s?
The 60s is really important with civil rights. During the 60s and the early 70s is when a lot of the changes that are for the better that are today happened in the 60s.
Well, it was a pretty progressive time, I guess.
There was a lot of women's lib and a lot of changes in social structure, and I think it was a really, really important decade for women, especially.
I feel like a lot of progress was made in the 60s. That was sort of a defining time in America.
We landed on the moon, and that was huge, so 69. Gosh, I think we would have been a lot less beautiful now if it hadn't been for that time. That freeing of our conservative values and narrow view of the world and the way it has to be.
But I think it actually changed a lot of American social institutions and ways in which Americans live and talk about things.
A new generation of historians has taken on the story of the 60s. Declassification of government documents has enabled new interpretations of a story those of us who lived through it thought we knew. Jeremy Suri wrote a book called Power and Protest. He makes the case that a lot of the foreign policy of the 60s was a response to domestic unrest. And as he told Anne Strainchamps, this was a global phenomenon.
It's this moment when you have synchronized unrest in very diverse cultural societies. We tend to presume that cultural diversity means cultural separation. I think the 60s is an example of how cultural diversity also means cultural interconnection. It's amazing to me that you have Chinese students, Russian students, German, French, American, Mexican, Japanese students all going into the streets at the same time.
See, I didn't know that. And play some of that out, because, for instance, I think if you ask most Americans, were there any other student protests going on in the 60s, most of us might remember, say, France and the student protests in 1968. I don't remember a Russian student protest movement.
Well, what you have in these societies is, of course, differences in the kinds of movements, but there are major things happening. For example, in Russia, you have all kinds of informal student resistance that's occurring that the Soviet leadership is very, very conscious of. For example, Soviet students who refuse to join the mandatory youth league. There are all kinds of crises about that. Students who engage in public drunkenness on a scale that they didn't before. Now, you can say that's just young people being young people, but there's no doubt when you go back and look at the records of what these students are saying in their diaries and in their journals and things of that, that they're saying this is our way of protesting against the system. And what's most significant to me is that the Soviet leadership recognized it in those terms. There's all kinds of discussion within the KGB, within the Politburo, about how we're losing our youth.
So there was that same sense of an entirely new generation, that this was a generational difference and the youth were rebelling against authority.
Exactly. I think what cuts across these societies is that the leaders in these societies feel they're out of touch with the younger people at the very same time that they're hinging their ideologies on appealing to these young people. Well, I mean, what's curious is that Khrushchev and Kennedy are both saying we're going to mobilize our public and build real communism and build a new frontier, but the very people they hope to be speaking to are tuning them out.
Hmm. Where else besides the USSR and the U.S.?
China. There's a lot of it there. China is, of course, a slightly different case in that the actual leadership, Mao himself, encourages students to rebel. The Red Guards are sort of following Mao's initial inspiration, but they quickly turn against him. There's a wonderful moment I describe when in 1967 he goes to meet with some of these Red Guards who he sees as his little red children, and his bodyguards tell him, "You better leave. You better just leave this town. They're going to turn against you very quickly. They've decided that they're against all authority, including your authority as well." So even in China, where there is more manipulation early on, even
well,
there...
Well, and in China is where we think of the social... The revolutionaries were state-sanctioned. They were that was Mao leading his Red Army.
Yes, but of course, when you're the state leader and you're orchestrating anti-state revolution, there's a certain point at which it goes a little too far, even for someone like Mao. And that's the interesting thing in 67, 68, when he's really forced to pull back. And he, like Lyndon Johnson, becomes a prisoner in his own state government. It's a really interesting thing. Mao is afraid to go out, just as Lyndon Johnson was afraid to go out anywhere because he'd be confronted by protesters.
So what you see happening in the 60s is the emergence of this kind of international language of dissent. were the students at the time, the young people at the time, really aware of these global connections?
I think they were. I mean, what I argue in the book is that they were definitely aware that things were happening elsewhere. I'm amazed at how internationally aware many of these students were. It doesn't mean they were collaborating. I don't think that the connections in terms of planning and daily behavior were very strong across societies. But image mattered. Symbolism mattered. So one of the examples I like to look at is the role of the Prague Spring, which many people, the sort of movement toward socialism with a human face, led by young people in what is then Czechoslovakia in the early 1968. Americans, French students, German students don't really know too much about what's going on in detail, but the image of that as an alternative, as a third way, is very inspirational. Mm-hmm. And you find that rhetoric seeping into student activist activities in those other societies. The same is true for the Cultural Revolution. The best example there is France. The French students say, we are leading our own cultural revolution on the Chinese model.
What about the world's leaders? Do you think they saw this as a large, widespread global youth movement, or were they each so focused on their own domestic problems that they weren't looking at what was happening in other places?
I think they come very quickly to see this as a global problem, and this is a case where there is new material we didn't have before. While a lot of the material on the student activities, the newspapers, the posters, all the really fun stuff to read has been available for a long time, a lot of the government documents have only just become available the last 5 to 10 years because of classification issues. And what we find is that leaders talk very explicitly about this, even though they're from different countries, in the same way, as a global phenomenon. My favorite example, which I cite in the book at length, is the CIA report produced in March of 68 for Lyndon Johnson. He asked the CIA to address this issue. And they produce a report, first of all, that says it's not the communists who are behind this. I mean, you expect the CIA to say this is all about communists. But no, they say this is not a problem of communists. This is a problem of industrialized society and modernization. And the title of their report is Restless Youth Around the World. And the report is more than 100 pages, goes through all the major countries. And the conclusion it comes to is that what we face is not a problem of East versus West, but young versus old.
Wow. I get this picture of, I mean, were there ever world summits in which Khrushchev or Brezhnev and Nixon and Willy Brandt all sat down and said, kids today?
Yes, actually. I mean, that's where I find this so exciting. My argument in the book is that detente, this period of, shall we say, softening Cold War rhetoric, more cooperation among traditional Cold War enemies, symbolized most by Nixon's trip to China in February 72 and then his trip to the Soviet Union in May 72, is all about this. When we read the minutes of what they actually said, in particular Nixon and Mao, they spend more time kvetching and complaining about the students than they do talking about strategic policy.
They actually talked about this
absolutely
together?
Absolutely. One of my favorite moments is when Mao says to Nixon, I would have voted for you if I could have. I like rightists. This is Mao saying this to Nixon. And then Nixon says to Mao, well, we both come from the same kind of place. We have our feet on the ground. And the problem is we just have students at home, young people. He says young people at home just don't understand politics. What grows up in the international system is a sense of identification between leaders who have opposite ideologies, men like Mao and Nixon who have spent their entire careers criticizing one another. They come together because they now see that they have more pressing problems at home, and they believe that since they're of the same generation, they can understand one another where their own students can't. Before Nixon goes to China, he makes this famous visit to the Lincoln Memorial late at night, and he tries to talk to the students there who are out there protesting Vietnam, and he gets nowhere. I mean, the students are amazed that he comes out to talk to them. But he gets them. He can't communicate. He's speaking a totally different language from them. But he can talk to Mao. He can talk to Brezhnev. And that's what changes. And to me, that's how this global set of student movements transformed international politics.
This is so interesting because the story about détente that we're usually told, the traditional narrative, is that it has everything to do with nuclear arms escalation, that it was a way of trying to, you know, prevent the U.S. and the USSR from blowing each other and the rest of the world up. This isn't how you see it?
Well, that's certainly part of it. I mean, these are not mutually exclusive things. There is a push at this point to manage the nuclear arms race, as the United States and the Soviet Union, first of all, have reached near parity. We can now blow each other up 80 million times, and that's about enough, people come to think. It's getting more and more expensive to do this. So it is about managing that. But what's amazing to me is how little is accomplished in that area and how little it comes up in conversations. I mean, let's be frank. Until the end of the 1970s and early 1980s, not a single nuclear weapon is destroyed as a result of any of these agreements. The only agreements they make are not to build some new things. But they don't actually reduce anything. It's just stabilization. It's much more about taking the existing status quo and protecting it against problems internally, students and others, and external problems, small states that are posing new kinds of risks.
What do you see as the lessons of this new history of the 60s for today, for student radical leaders today, for people who are protesting the Iraq War?
I see a number of lessons. The first, I think, is that it's important not to polarize politics in the way that a lot of activists did, as did politicians at the time. I think activists are most effective not when they're just storming the barricades, so to speak, but when they're also infiltrating and working through the institutions of government. And one of the mistakes that was made in the 1960s in all of these societies, and it was made because, in a sense, they weren't given many options, the students said, we're going to renounce the existing political system, we're going to build a new one. One of the reasons
they should have all run for Congress instead.
Absolutely. I think, and not all of them, but they should have gotten more involved in politics. I think that they underrated the degrees to which, especially within a democratic society, a flawed democratic society, but nonetheless a democratic society, one can work within institutions to some extent. That wasn't an option for Soviet and Chinese citizens, but it was an option for American and German and French student activists. And I think more of that needs to be done. I think also people have to spend more time learning about politics. There was a remarkable naivete about a lot of the protesters, a wonderful idealism, but also a remarkable naivete about the workings of politics. Many were very good at articulating hard-hitting criticisms of existing policy, but not offering alternatives. And that's one of the things that left the door open for the Richard Nixons and others. It's almost as if the student protesters knew what they hated, didn't really know what they wanted at a certain level. And that's part of that's being young, right? Part of that's also not having enough knowledge about politics. And I see that being recreated today.
Well, I was going to ask, what kind of parallels do you see between our foreign policy situation today and the period of time in the 60s? I mean, do you see President Bush, for instance, and his decision to move into Iraq as very similar to decisions our presidents made in the 60s?
Well, there are certain similarities, of course, with the exertion of presidential power without the kind of popular support for what's being done. What's different, and the differences strike me more than the similarities, what's certainly different is there isn't any kind that I've seen of really organized young activism about this. I hear a lot of people complaining, and I hear some students and others also supportive of what's happening, but there isn't the kind of organized, passionate young activism. There are a lot of people out there like Michael Moore and others who are upset about what the president's doing, but there's nothing like a student movement about what's happening in Iraq. Students that I teach at the University of Wisconsin, students I see when I lecture around the country, are very curious and interested in what's happening, but they're not passionately and personally engaged in any kind of political movements. They're very apolitical.
Jeremy Suri is a historian at the University of Wisconsin. His book is called Power and Protest, Global Revolution and the Rise of Détente. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. To buy this program on cassette, just call the radio store. Their number is 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 26B, The 60s. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, Ann Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Charmaine Tryon-Petit, with engineering help from Kirill Owen and Marv Nunn.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Here's the bad news. You can get the thing you most want, a BMW or the winning lottery ticket, and you still won't be any happier. The good news? You can survive the most devastating catastrophes, and you'll be back on your feet in less time than you think. Next week on To the Best of Our Knowledge, the science of happiness. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.